This conversation on COVID-19 was made possible by Discovery. Hello, I'm Alec Hogg, and this is episode 2 of Inside COVID-19. Coming up, South Africa's president fires a powerful salvo in the war against the virus. Discovery's head of clinical excellence unpacks where in the cycle the nation is now after the latest infection figures. We get a view from the investment world that this is like a world war, but is likely to be a relatively short one of only around 90 days. There's more good news emerging from Asia, where there are increased signs of a return to normality. And we get an on-the-ground report from our colleague in London. First, in the COVID-19 headlines today, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced a host of measures to combat COVID-19, spearheaded by a 21-day total lockdown that starts at midnight on Thursday night. In terms of this, citizens will be instructed to stay at home, except when needing to purchase food or medical supplies. It'll be enforced by the military and the police. The country is taking its lead from an international experience where those countries that have acted swiftly and firmly have done best in containing the spread of the virus. Ramaphosa said the measures would have lasting economic costs, but that the cost of not acting now would be far greater. Interestingly, a solidarity fund has been created, seeded by government, with 150 million rand. Ramaphosa also said that the Rupert and Oppenheimer families have each contributed 1 billion rand to help small business. The transcript of the full speech and audio is on biznews.com. Even before the president's latest update, South Africans were certainly getting the message that this is super serious and social distancing is needed, as is the call to work from home. Traffic patterns in Johannesburg resemble the calmness of the Christmas holidays, while restaurants are empty. Here's Ocean Basket's chief executive, Grace Harding.
Our sales over the weekend were about 58% down. And up until the other day, I was still thinking about, gee whiz, what are we going to do to keep the trade going, to keep the customers coming in? And then I woke up this morning and I thought, well, I guess we need to get some advice from our forefathers, because it feels like it is World War III with different ammunition. And as a restaurant group, obviously eating out is not a necessity like toilet paper, which has become number one on the list, apparently. But we definitely are seeing a massive decline.
On the global front, U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has signaled that he will do whatever it takes to pump in money to keep the U.S. economic wheels turning. The Fed will extend loans to any business that requests help, throwing in hundreds of billions of dollars to prevent COVID-19 from turning into another global financial crisis. Powell says unlimited amounts of treasury bonds will be purchased to prevent credit markets from seizing up as they did last week. U.S. share prices opened sharply lower but recovered well on the news of stimulus by the Fed. Worldwide infections of COVID-19 surged past 350,000 on Monday, double the number of a week ago. Deaths rose by 2,000 to over 15,500. 10% of these are in the US, where deaths have now risen to 473, the sixth highest in the world after Italy, China, Spain, Iran, and France. Iran's infections now total 23,000, and that includes 24 members of the Iranian parliament. Australia tightened its measures, with restaurants and bars now being closed, and in India, a lockdown has been declared in several states. In China, the government reported just 39 new cases, all of them imported, as well as 9 deaths in Wuhan. New Zealand has moved to its highest lockdown level, instructing that any outside activity must be solitary. Well, it's a warm welcome to Nolotando Nemetswerani, the head of the Center for Clinical Excellence at Discovery. Nolu, can you give us an update on the infections in South Africa? What's the latest number you've heard?
The latest I've heard is 402 cases right now. And I think we are also very much aware that there is a testing backlog. So whatever the current number is, we could be seeing more in the next coming days as the tests are being processed.
That's almost double where we were yesterday.
Yeah, this is 134, I think, new cases just today.
Why has it, well, maybe you can explain to us the exponential growth that we've seen in the last few days.
So I think if you look at the bulk of the cases, there is still some travel history. But we are also seeing local transmission right now. So I think it's people who have come back home and, you know, they have experienced symptoms and they have met testing criteria and they are testing positive. So I think the worrying trend is that we are also seeing people with no travel history testing positive, which talks to the issue of local transmission.
Mm. Why is that worrying?
I think once you have local transmission, it means you no longer then are going to rely on travel history. And then it means we're going to have person-to-person transmission, community spread, which could be quite devastating if we do not follow strict preventive measures to curb this. And I think all the countries that started the way we did, where they did not implement strict or stringent criteria upfront, they ended up overwhelmed with widespread communities, community infections.
So how well is South Africa prepared?
I think we are as prepared as we can be. I think the Department of Health, the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, have been working hard for quite some time to prepare. But I think we also understand that our healthcare system, with whatever preparedness measures we can put in place, it is still a very fragile healthcare system that if we have high volumes of patients that require some form of hospitalization or even intensive care, our system will not be able to cope. I think taking some lessons from, developed countries like Italy, where they probably have got, a better infrastructure and better, resources than us, they are also not coping with the volumes of cases that they are seeing. So I think that is the worrying trend from our side, that once we get to very high numbers of patients who may be requiring hospitalization and also intensive care, our system will not be able to cope.
Roughly how many of the people who are infected with the virus will need hospitalization?
So the current data shows that 20% of infected individuals will require hospitalization. And out of that, 5%. So if you look at 100% split, 80% will be mild and maybe those can be managed in the out-of-hospital environment. And then with the 20%, there's 15% hospitalized without requiring intensive care and the 5% requiring intensive care admissions. And I think we also know that we've got very limited ICU beds. So if we do get into a situation where that 20% is contributing to high volumes of patients, that's where it may be very difficult. I mean, if you look at Italy, for example, they have to decide which patients they let go and which patients they treat. And I think it's a very difficult situation to find yourself in as a health professional or as a government, to have to decide which citizens will get care and which will not.
It sounds, it is incredibly serious. What can the government do to react against this?
So I think it's really learning from other countries, taking some important learnings from countries that have managed to curb the spread. You know, we talk about flattening the curve, and I think South Africa needs to be, seriously thinking about flattening the curve. And I think we also it's important for us to take learnings from countries that actually delayed, responding. So I think from our side as a country, we need to think carefully about how we prevent that widespread community infections, that we might find ourselves in that situation very soon. How do we prevent us from, experiencing what Italy is experiencing now? Taking lessons from other countries like Singapore, taking lessons from other countries like South Korea, you know, combining those lessons and obviously adapting them for our setting and making sure that we do not really overwhelm our system with infections that we may not be able to cope with.
Now, we know that the president is in touch with the top scientists in China. We know that the information flow to South Africa is probably as good as anyone in the world. But is more now needed to be done to stop the further infections? And if so, what?
So I think we are waiting very patiently for the president's, a statement later today to see how we strengthen, the response that South Africa has already, announced about a week or so ago. I think for me, the worrying trend is that the general public, I'm not sure that they understand the gravity of the situation. And I think people are still continuing as if nothing is going on. You know, we talk about social distancing. People are making jokes and fun about what it means. And in actual fact, this is one of the most important interventions that we can implement right now so that we really get to that flattening of the curve. We know that one person who is infected can infect about 2.5 people. So if you can minimize that, contact with people who are infected. And also, I think for me, really thinking about people who are infected, making sure that they properly isolate in their home environment if they are not hospitalized. So there are certain things that I'm just looking and thinking that people are not really taking seriously and the spread is going to continue. And we know that if we don't implement those social distancing, principles early on, we may sit in a very different position. And considering other, issues that South Africa has in terms of other infections that are already prevalent in our setting, this may be quite devastating, really, if the government does not, enforce even more stringent, measures going forward. So I think there's been a lot spoken about in the past few days around maybe a shutdown or a lockdown, which other countries have implemented. Maybe this is the time for us to consider that as a country as well.
How will you know if you've got COVID-19?
So I think right now, the bulk of the people would have either traveled and they come back and some of them come back feeling a bit. So the most important symptom will be fever. Some patients will have a sore throat. We've had other people complaining of a sore throat, a dry cough, and some actually getting shortness of breath, which is more the chest symptoms now. So I think those are the common symptoms, but are not limited to that. There are, other people who present differently. And I think, the constellation of symptoms over time, we are going to understand as more and more people get infected and start reporting symptoms. And I think we see even internationally data keeps changing and we keep seeing, new evidence around other symptoms that some of the positive patients are reporting.
And how long does it last?
So this is quite interesting in the sense that, remember, from infection to actually the onset of symptoms, most people will be asymptomatic until maybe day 5 to 7. So by that time, obviously, the virus has been in the body and has been, multiplying for some time before you become symptomatic. So from the onset of symptoms, it varies from person to person and also depending on the severity of the disease. So for people with mild symptoms, they may be cleared of the infection in a week or two. But what we are seeing also is that even though they may test, they may be asymptomatic, they may continue to test positive, meaning that they still have some form of viral shedding. So I think, we know what we know, but there's still a lot that we do not know. And considering that some patients may present with severe disease, recovery may take much longer for those patients compared to people with mild disease. So there is, I mean, we were talking about 14 days. I think now we are thinking 21 days. So there is, you know, as we start to see more and more patients and understanding the data more, you know, we will revise and also have a better understanding of the duration of illness with this particular virus.
So it's still too unknown now to be able to say to someone who does get sick that it's 3 weeks, say, after you've been feeling these symptoms, that you can go back to work.
No, definitely. We cannot just go with the time frame because there's still a lot that we do not know. So we'll be guided, obviously. If you look right now, when people are symptomatic and they are confirmed to have the disease, most of them, in fact, all of them right now, maybe the testing process and protocol will change with time. But before you can be cleared, you have to have two negative results. So there are some people who have, been confirmed, have had symptoms, are now asymptomatic, but they are still testing positive. So, like I'm saying, we still are going to learn a lot, and we can then, based on that understanding, then maybe have, you know, better recommendations going forward. But right now, it is really about collecting the data. And some patients may have mild symptoms early on and then, have severe symptoms later on. And I mean, we it's important to actually get the data and also interview some of these patients and understand the disease process better.
Is there any update on immunization or vaccines?
So, you know, when I talk about vaccines, I always emphasize the fact that vaccine development is very complex. So if you look at vaccine development in general, it takes many years. So and the reason for that, remember, you will do the testing in the lab and then you will go and do your animal studies, which we call preclinical studies. After that, once it has passed those phases, then you have to do human trials. So human trials are going to take a few months before you can actually get to a point where you've got a commercially available vaccine. And remember, the human trials must show that the vaccine is safe and it is efficacious. So right now, I mean, we have been given a timeline of about 12 to 18 months based on a fast-tracked process. So we are looking at getting this sometime next year. So in the meantime, there's a lot of work being done in terms of testing treatments that can help patients, you know, to recover better. There are various treatments. I'm sure most people have been, you know, reading, some of the reports around some of the drugs, the antimalarial, you know, antiretrovirals, So there's been a lot of various drugs that have been, you know, tried in some countries, and you know, promising results have been reported. But unfortunately, from a treatment point of view, there is no confirmed or approved treatment right now. Everything is still in trial phase. There is currently no vaccine that is available, which is why we really emphasize the preventative measures and social distancing being one of the most important at this point.
And for South Africans, apart from social distancing, how can they protect themselves, perhaps through building their own immunity? Are there any, is there any advice you can give us there?
I think there it's the advice that we always give. And I mean, for me, yes, we're talking COVID-19 now, but we're going to be getting into the flu season. So this is really the physical activity bits we talk about. So it's exercise, good nutrition. So when we talk about good nutrition, it's nutrition. It's a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, because that's where you get your vitamin supply. And generally just, you know, hydration, all the good things that we advocate for will apply for COVID-19 as well. Good sleep, because we know that sleep also is not a good, if you sleep well and, you know, enough hours, it's good for your immune system as well. So I think it's just the basic, messages that we've been advocating for even before COVID-19 hit us.
Nolu, just to close off with, there was a trading statement today from Famous Brands, and they have operations in the UK and in South Africa. And they said that in the UK, they saw the virus really hitting them on the 1st of March. In South Africa, the 16th of March. Is that about right from your experience that South Africa appears to be about 2 weeks behind countries like Britain?
Yes, and I think, I mean, there's been quite a lot of speculations around why, you know, we were not hit as early as others. I mean, there have been speculations around the weather and all that. But I mean, if you look at our initial cases that we saw, they were not, you know, they were imported cases from other countries. So I think, I mean, if you think about the spread of the disease, it has almost been in the Northern Hemisphere countries, with some of the Southern Hemisphere countries being affected. So I think for me, you know, as we get more data, we will soon understand the patterns of spread, whether there's seasonality involved, and also whether, you know, there are other factors that may have influenced the delays in us seeing this infection. But I think now that we are in it, it is very important from a South African point of view to not ignore the lessons learned from other countries as we fight, you know, COVID-19 going forward. Because I think, as you can see, we're going to be overwhelmed with the number of cases, and something drastic needs to happen for us to prevent further spread.
The local stock markets had another tough session, but experienced market watcher David Shapiro is already seeing some light. The deputy chairman of Sasfin Securities reckons the market has now absorbed the shock, and although it's still a war zone, it is likely to be a short war, probably one only lasting 90 days. Why do you think that 90 days could be the term?
Maybe I'm too optimistic, or maybe I've been around too long. But the one thing about markets is that once they begin to discount the bad news, people start to look differently at share prices or at life. And I think we've seen, the worst in the news. In other words, there's no more shock value. I call it shock value in that we know it's around. We know we're going to lockdown. We know all of that. You know, when Goldman Sachs comes out and says, oh, the US economy is going to be 30% down, we know that. We closed the world down. So what do you expect? You know, we don't expect anything else. So that kind of news is not really forcing us out anymore. It's only the marginal players that are saying, okay, let's get out now. So I would imagine we're going to start seeing the signs of a bottoming of the market. It's not going to feel like that. You know what I mean? It's not going to feel like that to you. But that's why I say we're probably closer to the end than the beginning.
Mm.
And also, sorry, after a few months or after a few weeks of this, Alec, people start to say, hold on a sec, I can't stay holed up. You know, I'm going to get out. I'm going to start doing things. And they look at ways in which to get their life back in normal. So they will start to go to Grace's restaurant or start the Uber Eats and start spending and trying to improve the lifestyle that they're leading. And I'll come to other things as we talk as well. So I'm saying, hold on a sec. Don't position yourself for disaster. Rather, try and position yourself for what things are going to look like when this ends.
Isn't it just the right thing to do now is not to try and catch any falling knives and not to throw good money potentially after bad, but just to sit on the sidelines, as you've been advising actually over the last couple of weeks, and just wait for things to settle?
Right. Exactly right, you know, and look for opportunities. Start thinking, you know, start thinking about your portfolio and where you want to be. What will the world look like? I don't think it's going to change. I think we're going to go back to where we are. Although I think that when I say go back to where we are, I still think the same economy will prevail. I've been a big believer in the tech economy.
I asked another guest on Rational Radio today, Perpetua's Delphine Govender, whether she agreed. David was saying, yes, he agrees that it is like a war that's going to last 90 days. How are you seeing it?
Well, I think what both the observations by both, obviously, you know, highly experienced people that are seeing it and have experienced more than just kind of, you know, 2 or 3 decades, is that is showing you that actually no one knows what the scenarios are going to be. So what we're sitting with is we're sitting with incredible uncertainty. And I think what's hard, and you know, when you ask David, have you seen anything like this before, David? It's always the tricky thing is that why this feels so different. And I mean, I started my investment career as an analyst in March of 1998, so about 22 years ago. And we were just coming into this kind of peak of this, you know, incredible bull market in South Africa. The likes of the Steinhoffs and all of that were listing back then, and then hit our first crisis. But where this one's different is that we've got these two threats. We've got this public health threat, which is very real, and then we've got this economic threat, which is multifaceted because it's the supply side, the demand side, the whole financial system. So why we're not sure and why we're sitting with this uncertainty is that in the response from government, from policymakers, from kind of the war rooms, you know, in every single kind of country and government right now, is trying to address all of these things. When historically, when we've had bubbles burst, or event-driven issues, it's typically been constrained to a manageable kind of almost space. And so now we're sitting with a situation where no one can prove or disprove what our worst-case scenario is going to be.
Those full interviews are available on the BizNews radio channel. The news from Asia continues to encourage. The number of new COVID-19 infections is falling, and hard evidence is emerging that business is returning to a semblance of normality. Yum, the owner of KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, says 95% of its stores in China have either partially or fully reopened. And in this interview, Jerome Phillips, the chief executive of an American company called Land's End, tells Bloomberg's Carol Masser and Jason Kelly that supply chains in the Middle Kingdom are now also returning to normal.
It's a little bit different depending where we are in the world. We have offices in Asia and Europe and here. For our workers in Asia, they're actually on their way back to work. Our Japan business has been picking up. Our sourcing office in China is starting to come back in. And where we originally thought supply chain was going to be a big problem, we see very, very few issues there, if any. In Europe and in Wisconsin, where we're based, we are on, well, many of the employees are working from home, staggered staff if you're in the office, and the warehouse is still working and shipping product out, but that's, again, on staggered staffing. And in New York, where we have a small design office, the people there are home and working from home. Everybody's getting used to working on Teams by Microsoft. Everybody's getting used to working on FaceTime. People are actually finding that they're having some pretty good conversations digitally and making decisions faster and moving on. Personally, I had my whole family in the house today. Everybody's out of New York. And
so, Jerome, help us understand sort of your customer at this point, because we know you're in touch with them as well. You know, brick-and-mortar stores are closed, I believe. But, you know, online continues. What are you seeing as you sort of get down into the customer sphere?
With the stores, we have 26 stores, so not a very right. large store base, and we've closed that over the weekend, and that'll be closed for a few weeks. Online, our online customer had been very robust at the end of 2019 and then for the first few fiscal weeks of 2020. Up until about 10 days ago, where we started to see people's demand slow down and really change rapidly day by day. I think that people are much more focused, or have been in the last few days, of just, you know, can I get the basic essentials? I believe over the course of the next few days, as people start to see that, you know, you can get food, you can go in the grocery store and get chicken and toilet paper, you'll be fine. Their lives are going to start to turn to, now this is the new norm for the time being, how do I manage through? So, you know, we're staying on it day by day. We are seeing some people enticed by discounts a little bit, but that's mm-hmm. not what we're really looking at right now. I think it's important that people have the opportunity to shop from home and from the safety of their own homes, but at the same time, I don't think it's right to take advantage of any difficult situation.
You know, it's interesting. I want to go back to what you said about China. Give me an idea, because we had a story in the magazine last week that was trying to, that, you know, the question is China really getting back on track? Because from what our reporters found out is that, you know, yes, energy usage is up, which is a key indicator to figuring out what's going on in the Chinese economy. But we're also hearing that there are projections that factories have to hit in terms of energy usage, and that there are just people going in and turning on the lights. From what you're seeing, what can you really clearly tell us about how much they've gotten back? Because I think the Chinese story does help us maybe hopefully figure out how we get back and how long it takes.
Well, for us, it's really two stories. One is China, but also one is Japan. On the China side, we had been very worried about supply chain straight away. Having said that, China only represents about 20% of our production worldwide. The guys were late, definitely getting back from Chinese New Year, but as we looked at production schedules and have been working with the factories directly, we're finding that almost everything is going to be on time or up to 2 or 3 weeks late, which is actually okay for us from a delivery standpoint. Japan was a little bit of a different story, where we had an ongoing business in Japan, and we ship out of Yokohama, which is where they had the large cruise ship
right.
that was quarantined for quite some time. Many of our employees ended up working from home. They weren't coming into the office. We had customer service reps, which were working from home on laptops. And that went on for several weeks, but they're coming back into work now as the cases have gone down to, you know, small numbers or even zero in some cases. So we see, you know, it's like Farr's law, you know, there's a curve going up and there's a curve going down. And it seems as though Asia's on the other side of the curve right now.
Well, our colleague Linda von Tilburg is based in London. And Linda, this morning we got maybe confirmation that the South Africa is about 2 weeks behind the UK. It came from an interesting source. Famous Brands, who've got operations in the UK as well as in South Africa, said that the virus hit them, or their business, on the 1st of March in England and on the 16th of March in South Africa. So I guess you living in London can tell us what we can expect in 2 weeks' time. Is it... have you got some insight into what South Africa can look forward to with some trepidation?
Well, yes, I think what happened here is people weren't terribly serious about self-isolation in the beginning. So I think what happened was, you know, yesterday, which was a Sunday, people went to the beach, people were walking in national parks, a lot of people took their caravans and headed up north to Scotland, to the Highlands, and camped out there. And the government was absolutely appalled and said, that's not self-isolation. So I think they weren't taking it too seriously. I think the measures here were slightly less strict in some respects. And I think the government here is going to clamp down more. With regard to economic activity, I think what is different here, I think South Africa is still going ahead. People are still going to the supermarkets, where here that is happening, but literally all restaurants have been closed down. And even takeaways, McDonald's announced today, and Nando's, that they've totally closed their businesses for the foreseeable future. So I think the total clampdown and people realizing the seriousness of it is, I think, we're probably a little bit ahead.
That's interesting, because in the UK, initially there was a discussion about, well, allowing the virus to go through the population, build immunity in the herd, get over it quickly, and you can get back to normal. But now, clearly, after I think it was that Imperial College report that has been so well publicized, a different approach.
Yes, there is a different approach. The deaths now are 220. It's mounting up. They think there's 5,000 confirmed cases, but it's probably so much more than that because they're not testing widely. I've got two children who work in London some of their friends have had it. And they phoned what's called the National Health Service here, the NHS, and they would just say, well, if you're okay, you know, we're not going to test you or anything. So I think they have no idea of the actual numbers. But what happened slightly differently here is that they isolated the elderly. People above 70 have to stay home for 12 weeks. I think that's what they were thinking, that this herd, you know,
immunity.
That the immunity, that the herd immunity would work like a vaccination, but they've abandoned that and isolated the elderly people. And I think they're becoming more and more stricken. They're a little bit appalled about, you know, people gathering what they call in clusters. New measures are coming today, and they, well, it's speculation that they're going to say that people should only move around in twos. No more people than two people together. So they're worried about people getting together in parks and festivals and churches and stuff. And I think new measures are coming. Where we are ahead of you, I think, is in the numbers. South Africa doesn't have the cases that they have here. I drove last night into London. We live just outside London to drop off my son. And it was kind of, I think that was yesterday afternoon, but there was sort of, there was another press conference, and the government said, you guys really need to take this seriously now. You know, there's no, this sort of British thing of we allow you to do things and we asking you nicely, and it's not happening. So it was quite interesting for me last night to notice that the streets were empty. I went to an area called Clapham Junction, which is where the young people live. And there wasn't anybody on the streets, literally nobody. I saw a couple of people at bus stops, maybe waiting. And I saw these little scooters driving around with Uber Eats and Deliveroo and so on. So I think it's finally sinking in, but possibly too slow. That's possibly why the spread is faster.
This has been episode 2 of Inside COVID-19. Until tomorrow, I'm Alec Hogg. Cheerio. This conversation on COVID-19 was made possible by Discovery.